a felt tip and get signing. That's the least you can do for your drinking buddy.
Are you really him?
Asked the labourer, thrusting his newspaper at me. Indeed I am, I said, signing my name. When I saw it, I ordered another batch of copies straight away, the newspaper vendor told me, selling papers over people's heads. Yes, by all means go over. Herr Hitler will be glad to sign for you. In truth, I do not particularly like signing my name. You never know what people will do with a signature.
You can sign a piece of paper in all innocence, but the next day someone else will paste a declaration above it, and suddenly you find you have given away Transylvania to some corrupt Balkan entity, or surrendered unconditionally, even though your bunkers are still full of weapons of retaliation with which you could turn around the war whenever you fancied.
In the end, however, my signature on a newspaper seemed harmless enough. I was delighted, moreover, that for the first time nobody was complaining that I wasn't writing Herr Stromberger or whoever, but my own name.
There, please, across the photo.
Could you write for Helga?
Could you say something bad about the Kurds next time? We should have gone to war together back then. We would have won. A small girl was pushed to the front with her newspaper, and I took deliberate care to sign it slowly. Let them photograph this. Young people trust the Führer as much now as they did in the past. And not only the young. An ancient woman approached me with one of those modern walking frames on wheels and a twinkle in her eye. She held out her newspaper and said in a quivering voice,
"Do you remember 1935 in Nuremberg? I was in the window watching you march by. I always thought you were looking at me. We were so proud of you. And now, well, you haven't changed one bit."
"Nor have you," I gaily fibbed, shaking her hand. I felt touched. Not that I could remember this woman, obviously, but her sincere loyalty had a charm all of its own. At any event, when a nervous Sensenbrink telephoned me, I was calmly able to allay his concerns by describing to him this demonstration of trust by the Volk, and could rebuff the demands that we make a legal response. Nor was I daunted the following day. Naturally, the paper had suppressed the photographs of the public's affirmation. Instead, they printed the utterly irrelevant headline, "Loony YouTube Hitler, Now Germany Votes." Beside this were several photographs from concentration camps, showing the unattractive but alas necessary work of the SS. This made me rather indignant. A thorough investigation of major operations should never focus on those petty, isolated instances where the overall plan has caused a minor inconvenience. Such an analysis lacks all gravity. Wherever there is a large motorway enabling the transport of ton after ton of German goods, you will inevitably find a sweet little rabbit trembling by the roadside. Or you build a canal, thereby creating hundreds of thousands of jobs. And of course, you will encounter the occasional small farmer who sheds bitter tears because he has to relinquish his land. But for this, I cannot, I must not, ignore the future of the Volk. And when the need to eradicate millions of Jews, and there really were that many back then, has been recognized, you will always find the odd, naive, compassionate German who thinks, "Well, that Jew wasn't so bad after all. Surely we could have put up with this or that one for a few more years." For this reason, it is terribly easy for a newspaper to appeal to people's sentimental side. It is an old refrain. Everybody agrees that the rats must be exterminated, but when it comes down to it, sympathy for the individual rat is huge. Only sympathy, mind you. There is no desire to keep the rat. The two must not be confused. But it was precisely this confusion which knowingly underpinned the paper's questionnaire. The poll, which I doubt it was going to be an honest and fair one, offered three choices, eliciting from me
a grim smile. I could have dreamed this up myself. The options were: 1. Enough. Get the YouTube Hitler off our screens. 2. No, he's not funny, and my TV doesn't think so either. 3. Never seen him. Not interested in that Nazi rubbish. This was entirely to have been expected. Such claptrap is the slanderous bread and butter of the bourgeois gutter press, which quite clearly is still infected by the spirit of the Jews. It was something I would have to live with, particularly as the necessary facilities to accommodate these lying vermin were lacking. From a cursory piece of research, I had been able to establish that only 2 barracks were still standing in Dachau. A scandalous state of affairs. The crematoria would have to be fired up again after the first wave of arrests. Sensenbrink, of course, was in a high-velocity spin. It is always those great strategists whose nerves start to flutter first. "We're toast," he wailed repeatedly. "We're toast. My TV will be sweating bullets. We've got to give them an interview." I signalled to hotel reserver Savatsky that he should keep an eye on this loose cannon. By contrast, Madame Bellini was positively blooming. Nobody since Ernst Hanstengel had managed so successfully to sweet-talk the important and not-so-important people on my behalf. And she was a damn sight better-looking, too, a thoroughly attractive woman. On the 4th day, however, I gave in. Even now, it is the only thing I reproach myself for. I ought to have shown unyielding steeliness. But perhaps I was somewhat out of practice. And yet, in my wildest dreams, I could never have imagined what might happen. They had published a large photograph showing me accompanying my respectable secretary, Fräulein Kürmeier, to the door of the offices. The photograph, snapped in the bright light of early evening, had, as I was able to conclude thanks to long conversations with Heinrich Hoffmann back in the day, been wantonly and deliberately distorted. The image was unnecessarily blurred, as well as greatly enlarged, and it was presented as if the services of a highly experienced spy had been engaged to take the picture, which was utter nonsense, of course. On the day in question, I had decided to take a short walk and had gone with Fräulein Kürmeier to the exit, from where she caught the bus. In the photograph, I was holding open the door. Printed in bold above the image was the following: "Loony YouTube Hitler, who is the mysterious woman at his side?" They furtively creep out of a side door and then look around. The Nazi comedian and his mysterious beauty. The man who still refuses to tell Germany his name and who rails against foreigners, this self-proclaimed champion of decency, is conducting his sordid affair at twilight. Who is the mysterious woman he is courting? From a close acquaintance, Bildt learned the following. "That is punishment by association," I said coldly. "And poor Fräulein Kürmeier is not even related to me." We were sitting in the conference room, Madame Bellini, Sensenbrink, hotel reserver Savatsky, and myself. Inevitably, it was the great strategist Sensenbrink who asked,
"Come on, open the kimono. Is there anything going on between you and the Kürmeier girl? Are you dipping your pen in company ink?"
"Don't be ridiculous," Madame Bellini cut in. "Herr Hitler has opened the door for me too on occasions. Do you intend to ask me the same question?"
"We just need to proceed carefully," Sensenbrink said with a shrug.
"Proceed carefully," Madame Bellini retorted. "With what? I'm not going to waste a moment's thought on this distasteful business. Fräulein Kürmeier can do as she pleases. Herr Hitler can do as he pleases. We're not living in the '50s.
"Nonetheless, he mustn't be married," Sensenbrink insisted.
"At least, not if there's something cooking with Fräulein Kürmeier."
"You still haven't understood," Madame Bellini said, and then turned to me.
Well, are you married?
Actually, I am, I said.
Great,
Sensenwink moaned.
Let me guess,
Bellini said.
Since 1945? April?
Absolutely, I said.
It's extraordinary that the press release got out. At the time, you see, the city was teeming with Bolshevists, alas.
Without wishing to intrude on your personal life,
hotel reserver Savatsky said,
I think Herr Hitler can rightly be considered a widower.
You can say what you like, but even under fire, this Savatsky fellow was quick-witted, clear, reliable, pragmatic.
I cannot be 100% sure, I said, but I'm assuming Herr Savatsky is correct.
Well,
Madame Bellini said, turning to Sensenbrink, satisfied now?
It's my job to throw curveballs,
Sensenbrink said stroppily.
The question is, what are we going to do? Bellini said.
Do we have to do anything?
Savatsky said in a sober voice.
I agree with you, Herr Savatsky, I said. Or I would agree if this was just about me. But if I do nothing, those around me will be affected even more.
It may not do Herr Sensenbrink any harm, I said with a mocking glance, but I cannot expect you and the company to put up with it.
I would always expect us as a company to put up with it, but not our shareholders, not for 5 minutes,
Madame Bellini answered dryly.
Which means no interview on our terms, but on their terms. I will hold you responsible for ensuring that it does not turn out like that, I said.
And as I sensed that Madame Bellini was not as happy to take orders as Savatsky, I added quickly, But in this case you are absolutely right. We will grant them an interview.
Tell them it will be in the Adlon, and they can pay.
Your ski brain has gone totally off-piste, Sensenbrink teased me. In this situation we can hardly get them to agree a fee.
It's all about principle, I said.
I refuse to squander the folks' money on this press scum.
If they pay the bill, I'll be happy with that.
So when?
As soon as possible, Madame Bellini said quite correctly.
Let's say tomorrow. Then they might leave us in peace for a day.
I agreed.
In the meantime, we ought to intensify our own propaganda efforts.
Which means?
We must not allow our political opponents to enjoy control over reporting. This must never happen to us again. We need to publish our own newspaper.
So, maybe the Völkische Beobachter,
Sensenbrink sneered.
We're a production company, not a newspaper publisher.
Stir-fry that in your think-wok. Guys, it doesn't have to be a newspaper,
hotel reserver Savatsky interjected.
Herr Hitler's strength is his on-screen appearance. We've already got the videos, so why don't we post them on our own website?
All his appearances so far in HD, which will offer more than the clips already up on YouTube,
Madame Bellini reflected.
And it will give us a platform if we want to put out any particular bits of information, or our own view on things.
Sounds good. Have the digital media department prepare a few designs.
We concluded the conference.
Noticing a light still burning in my office as I left the room, I went to turn it off.
Until the Reich has converted fully to regenerative energies, one must be sparing with one's resources.
One seldom thinks of it at the time, but imagine the misery 30 years later when just outside El Alamein, one's tank lacks that very last drop of fuel to achieve the final victory. As I looked in, I could see Fräulein Kurmeier sitting absolutely still at her desk. It was only then that I realized I had not inquired how she was bearing up. Birthdays, bereavements, personal calls, these were all things which Traudl Junge used to remind me of, and more recently Fräulein Kurmeier. But in this case, of course, it had not happened. She was staring at the desktop in consternation. Then she looked up at me.
Do you know what sort of emails I'm getting?
She said weakly. I was deeply moved by the sight of this poor creature.
"I'm terribly sorry, Fräulein Kurmeier," I said. "I can easily stomach this sort of thing. I'm used to enduring such hostility when standing up for the future of Germany. I bear full responsibility. It is unforgivable when one's political opponents choose to attack lesser employees."
"But it's got nothing to do with you," she said, shaking her head. "It's just the usual built crap. You appear once in that shitty rag with tits plastered on every page, and then everyone's got it in for you. I'm getting, like, photos of men's dicks. I'm getting really nasty mail. People saying what they'd like to do to me. I stop reading after the first couple of words. I've been Volcania 17 for 7 years, but now I can forget it. That name's contaminated. And now," she said, sorrowfully pressing a key, "now it's like history."
Being unable to make a decision is not a pleasant feeling. If Blondie had still been alive, at least I would have been able to stroke her. In such moments, an animal, particularly a dog, is always good for relieving some of the tension.
"And it doesn't stop with the internet either," she said.
She stared blankly into the distance.
"At least on the internet you can read what people are thinking. But you can't do that on the street. You can only have a guess. And I'd rather not guess."
She snivelled. "I ought to have warned you in advance," I said after a moment's silence. "But I underestimated the enemy. I am really very sorry that you are having to pay for my error. Nobody knows better than I do that sacrifices have to be made for the future of Germany."
"Couldn't you just put a sock in it for a couple of minutes?" Fräulein Kurmeier said, looking rather exasperated. "FYI, this is not about the future of Germany. This is real. This isn't a joke. It isn't a performance either. It's my life these assholes are messing up with their lies."
I sat on the chair facing her desk. "I cannot stop for a couple of minutes," I said seriously. "Nor do I wish to stop for a couple of minutes. I will defend to the very last what I believe to be right. Providence put me in this post, and here will I stand for Germany until the last round is fired." You might well say, "All the same, can't Herr Hitler let up for a couple of minutes, just for once? In peacetime I would be prepared to, for your sake, dear Fräulein Kurmeier. But I do not wish to. I will tell you why. And then I'm sure you will no longer wish me to either." She gave me a quizzical look. "The very moment I start making concessions, I am not making them for your sake. Ultimately, I am doing it because this lying rag is forcing me to. Is that what you want? Do you want me to do what this newspaper demands of me?" She shook her head, slowly at first, then in defiance. "I am proud of you," I said. "And yet there is a difference between you and me. What I demand of myself, I cannot demand of everyone. Fräulein Kurmeier, I would perfectly understand if you were to cease working for me. I am certain that Flashlight would accommodate you somewhere else, where you would not be confronted with such unpleasantness." Fräulein Kurmeier sniffed again. Then she sat up straight and said with determination,
"Like hell I will, mein Führer."
Chapter 21. The first thing I saw was large lettering in the Gothic script. The word on the screen was Heimatseite. At once I picked up the telephone and called Savatsky.
"So, you seen it yet?" he asked,
and without waiting for an answer he said gleefully,
"Come out well, hasn't it?"
"Heimatseite," I asked. "What's that supposed to mean? What Heimat are we talking about?"
"Well, we can't exactly put homepage on your website, can we?"
"Really?" I said. "Why ever not?"
"But the Führer doesn't know foreign words."
I shook my head energetically. "Savatsky, Savatsky, what do you know about the Führer?"
This uptight Germanness is the worst attitude one can have. You must not confuse racial purity with cultural isolation. Don't be ridiculous. A home page is a home page. One doesn't call radar Funkortung und Abstandsmessung just because the English invented it.
Okay, Savatsky said. Home page is fine. I'll sort it. How'd you like it otherwise?
I haven't really had time to look, I said, inquisitively pushing the mouse device across the table. On the other end of the line, Savatsky was tapping away at his keyboard. Suddenly, a large home page appeared on my screen.
Hmm, he said. That doesn't really make sense anymore. Why should home page be in that old font?
Why must you make everything so complicated? I upbraided him. Just make it into Führer headquarters.
Aren't you always saying that you're not commander-in-chief of the Wehrmacht just at the moment? Savatsky said with a hint of irony.
Top marks for paying attention, I praised him. But this is symbolic, as with my email address. After all, I'm not the new Reich Chancellery either. I hung up and set about exploring my site. Right across the screen ran a bar, via which one could pay a visit to specific departments by maneuvering the mouse. One was Latest Dispatches, where we were planning to announce items of news, but which as yet contained little to read. Then came Film Reel, where a small window showed visitors my previous appearances. Then a short biography of me, in which it said that during the period from 1945 to my return, I had been on extended leave. This had been Savatsky's suggestion, and I had chuckled to myself at the thought that I had slept through the intervening years beneath the Kiefhäuser Hills, like the great Kaiser before me. On the other hand, given that I was unable to provide any better or more detailed information on the time that had elapsed, I agreed to this formulation. Another department was Ask the Führer. This was to serve as a channel of communication between me and my followers. Out of curiosity, I checked to see whether anybody had asked a question yet. And one gentleman had indeed sent me a communique. Dear Herr Hitler, I read with interest your theory about the relative values of different races. I have been breeding dogs for many years, and now I'm worried that I might be breeding an inferior strain. So, my question is, which is the best breed of dogs and which is the worst? And what is the Jew of the dog world? Yours, Helmut Berzel, Offenburg. I was delighted. A good question and an interesting one, too. Especially as I had been posed so many military questions of late, I had almost had enough of them. Moreover, military topics have limited entertainment value if one only ever receives bad news. In the early years of the war, we would often have stimulating discussions around the table on the most diverse of subjects. Latterly, I had really started to miss these. The dog-related question reminded me of this wonderful time. Eager to give the man an answer, I reached for my miracle telephone right away and searched for the somewhat complicated dictation function. Dear Herr Berzel, I began. Dog breeding has, in fact, advanced further than the reproduction and development of human beings. I paused briefly to consider whether I should provide Herr Berzel with a succinct answer, but my enthusiasm took over, and I decided to approach the subject with a thoroughness becoming the Führer of the German Reich. I would treat the question at length and produce a comprehensive, definitive response. But where to begin? There are dogs which are so intelligent that it is alarming. I spoke into the machine, in a measured way at first, then with increasing fluency. Dog breeding is thus an interesting example of where human beings could already be. It also shows us, however, where unrestrained racial mixing leads. For if they are left unattended,
dogs will mate indiscriminately. The consequences of this are to be seen predominantly in southern Europe, where mangy and feral mongrels roam and maraud, each more degenerate than the last. But where the hand of order intervenes, pure breeds develop, each one progressing towards perfection. Around the world there are, and I cannot help but put it as bluntly as this, more elite dogs than elite humans. A deficit which might have been eliminated by now had the German folk shown greater perseverance in the mid-40s of the previous century. I paused, wondering whether I was not being excessively harsh on my fellow Germans. But then again my comments had only been aimed at those who were by now quite old. The younger Germans, on the other hand, should have an inkling of the demands which would be made of them at a later date. Naturally, the reproduction and development of dogs are not subject to the same laws as those of human beings. Dogs are under the authority of humans. Humans control their nutrition and reproduction, which means that dogs will never have a problem with Lebensraum. For this reason, the aims of breeding are not always oriented towards a future battle for world domination. Consequently, the question of what dogs might look like had they been fighting for global supremacy over millions of years must remain pure speculation. What goes without saying is that they would have larger teeth and better weaponry. I consider it more than a mere possibility that dogs such as these would be able to use simple devices today, such as clubs, catapults, possibly even bows and arrows. I paused again. Would these superior master dogs indeed have primitive firearms by now? No, I concluded, that would be unlikely. Nevertheless, the racial differences are not so dissimilar to those of human beings, which justifies the question as to whether the canine world has its own Jew, the Jew hound, so to speak. The answer is, of course there is a Jew hound. I could already imagine what the hundreds of thousands of readers would be thinking at this stage, and thus I needed to preempt them. But this is not, as many might suspect, the fox. A fox can never be a dog, nor can a dog ever be a fox. So it follows that the fox cannot be a Jew hound. If anything, foxes have their own identifiable Jew fox, to my mind most readily seen in the fennec, which in typical Jewish fashion even denies its foxiness in its name. I had dictated myself into a mild rage. Fennec, I muttered darkly. What impudence! Then I said quickly, Fraulein Kurmeier, please cross out fennec and what impudence. This was one thing I did not like about my miracle telephone. There must be an eraser function, but I could not work out how to use it. We must conclude, therefore, I continued, that the Jew hound is to be sought amongst dogs. How to proceed here is quite clear. We must look for a grovelling dog, one which ingratiates and salivates, yet is poised to perform a cowardly ambush at any moment. It can be none other than the Dachshund. Yes, I can hear many dog owners, especially those from Munich, protesting, how can this be? Isn't the Dachshund the most German of all dogs? The answer is no. The most German of all dogs is the Alsatian, followed in descending order by the Great Dane, the Doberman, the Swiss Mountain Dog, but only those from German-speaking Switzerland, the Rottweiler, all Schnauzers, Munsterländers, and, why not, the Spitz, which even finds a mention in Wilhelm Busch. Un-German dogs, on the other hand, apart from those foreign introductions such as terriers, bassets, and other canine riffraff, are the Weimaraner, Nomen est omen, the vain spaniel, the unsporty pug, as well as all types of degenerate ornamental dogs. I switched off and then back on again at once. And those scrawny greyhounds. I pondered whether I had forgotten something important, but nothing came to mind.
Excellent. I was eager for the next question, but unfortunately none had been submitted. I pushed the mouse contraption along to the final department. Obersalzberg. Be the Führer's guest. Its function was similar to a hotel guestbook, and it had already attracted a fair few messages, even if not all were comprehensible. The serious comments were not a problem. I read, "All respect to you for your straight talking," or, "I watch every program. At last, here's someone prepared to dismantle the fossilized structures."
This seemed to be a pressing concern of the German Volk. Several people had mentioned the existence of such fossilized structures, or the dismantling of them. One fellow, a farmer, I presumed, spoke of tractors. Another seemed to imagine these structures were as entangled as embroidery thread when he referred to them as fossilized. In the end, it became clear what they were trying to say, and there are more essential skills in which a German should be proficient than orthography, which has a tedious tendency towards bureaucratic hair-splitting. Equally pleasing was the message, "Führer rules." This implied that I now had followers in France too, unless this was a typographical error, for I also saw the comment, "Führer rules." But maybe a certain Herr Rules was trying to achieve prominence at my expense. Several well-wishers exhorted me to keep at it, or demanded Führer for president. I was about to terminate my visit, when, further down the list, I caught sight of half a dozen absolutely identical entries sent by someone who signed himself Blood and Honour. To my surprise, the message was rather critical. "Stop your liars, you Jew Turk." Shaking my head, I called Savatsky to have someone remove this nonsense. Jew Turk. What was that supposed to be? He promised to sort it out and said I should make my way to the first page again. Across the screen were the words, "Führer Headquarters." It looked splendid. Chapter 22. Press work is a tiresome affair when the newspapers have not been brought into line. Not only for politicians like me, whose mission it is to save the German Volk. No, I find it absolutely incomprehensible that such a thing should be foisted on the people. Let us take business reports as an example. Every day another expert tells us what needs to be done. Then the following day a different, even more expert explains why this is wholly wrong and why the contradictory solution is the correct one. This is a classic case of that Jewish strategy, albeit these days largely without the involvement of Jews, the sole purpose of which is to disseminate the greatest possible chaos, which is why people in search of the truth have to buy even more newspapers and watch even more television broadcasts. In the past, no one paid the slightest interest to the business sections. But now, everybody feels obliged to devour them, only to be alarmed all the more by this financial terrorism. Buy shares, sell shares, now gold, now bonds, then property. The simple man is pressed into a secondary occupation as a financial expert. What this boils down to is that he is driven to gamble using his own carefully saved money as a stake. How preposterous! The simple man should work honestly and pay his taxes. In return, a responsible state should take away his financial worries. That is the very least it should do. Especially as this government, for preposterous reasons, no atomic weapons of their own and a host of similar excuses, doggedly refuses to let the people have free farmland on the Russian plain. It is, of course, the height of idiocy that the political elites should permit such scaremongering in today's press. Amidst this chaos, their own cluelessness is thrown into even sharper relief. And, as the general worry and panic increases, so does the sheer incompetence of these political jokers. This is fine by me, for it makes the folk more aware by the day that these are rank amateurs dabbling in positions of the highest responsibility. But what baffles me most of all is that millions didn't march on this parliamentary gossip chamber ages ago, wielding torches and pitchforks and chanting, "What are you doing with our money?" But the German is no revolutionary. One must not forget that, in German eyes, even the most reasonable and justified revolution of 1933 was only possible by means of an election. A revolution on prescription, so to speak. Now, I can assure you that I shall do my utmost this time, too. I had wanted to take Savatsky with me to the Adlon. Not that I expected any significant inspiration from him, but it seemed appropriate to turn up with an entourage, and useful, in the case of any controversial utterances, to have a witness with me. A witness, please note. But Sensenbrink insisted on coming too. I do not know whether Sensenbrink supposed he might be able to make some helpful contribution, or whether his intention was to monitor what I had to say. As I have come to realize, deep down, Sensenbrink is one of those subordinate business leaders who believe that nothing can work unless they themselves are involved in some form or another. I cannot warn enough against such nonsense. A truly universal genius emerges at most once every 100 or 200 years. A man who, besides countless other activities, has to assume supreme command of the Eastern Front as well, else all is lost. In general, however, these indispensable people turn out to be wholly dispensable as well as useless or worse, for very often they cause a mountain of damage too. I had chosen to wear a sober suit. Not that I was ashamed of my uniform, but I am of the opinion that occasionally it is no bad thing to present a bourgeois image, particularly as I am the ambassador for uncompromising opinions. We contested the Olympic Games in 1936 along these lines, and, as I have read, they recently tried to copy this overwhelming propaganda triumph in Peking, with very favourable results. When we arrived at the hotel, which had been decorated for Christmas, we were taken to the appointed conference room. And although I had endeavoured to arrive slightly late, it was somewhat annoying to find we were the first ones there. It may have been a deliberate strategy on the part of those press scribblers, but equally it could have been a coincidence. In any event, the door opened soon afterwards, and I was approached by a blonde woman in a suit. At her side was a corpulent photographer, who, in the tattered clothing particular to his profession, began to take pictures without being invited to. Before Savatsky or Sensenbrink could come up with any absurd ideas of making introductions like a head teacher, I stepped forward, removed my peaked cap, jammed it under my arm, and, with a "good afternoon," offered my hand to the lady.
"Pleased to meet you," she said coolly, but not uncordially. "Ute Kessler von Bild."
"The pleasure is all mine," I said. "I've read much of your writing."
"I was expecting you to give the Nazi salute," she said.
"Then I know you better than you know me," I replied, leading her to a table around which chairs had been arranged. "I had not been expecting a Nazi salute from you. Now, which one of us was right?" She sat and carefully placed her handbag on a vacant seat. This handbag culture, this positioning of the object immediately after sitting down, as if they were taking their assigned place with luggage in a train compartment, I bet that will not change for another 65 years.
"I'm delighted you finally found time for us," she said.
"You're not suggesting that I have favoured other newspapers over yours, are you?" I replied. "After all, you have
how shall I put it, been making the greatest efforts to engage with me.
"Well, you're worth writing about," she said. "Who are these gentlemen with you?"
"This is Herr Sensenbrink from Flashlight, and this," I said, pointing to Savatsky, "this is Herr Savatsky, likewise from Flashlight, an excellent man."
Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Savatsky's face beam, partly as a result of my praise, but perhaps also on account of the attention he was receiving from the reporter, a handsome woman after all.
Sensenbrink wore an expression which one could interpret either as competent or clueless.
"You brought along two minders," she smiled. "Do I look that dangerous?"
"No," I said, "but without these two gentlemen, I look completely harmless." She laughed, as I did.
What drivel!
My utterance made no sense from start to finish. But I admit that I slightly underestimated the young blonde woman, and at the time assumed that I would be able to satisfy her with a few cheerful platitudes. She took her telephone from the handbag, showed it to me, and said,
"You don't mind if we record the interview, do you?"
"Not if you don't," I said, bringing out my own telephone and passing it to Savatsky. I had no idea how to record entire conversations with it. Savatsky acted smartly, as if he had a jolly good idea. I decided to praise him again when the opportunity arose. A waiter came to the table to take our order and then departed. "Well," I said, "what would you like to know?"
"How about your name?"
"Hitler Adolf," I said, and my answer was enough to bring forth beads of sweat on Sensenbrink's forehead. It was as if I had never introduced myself before.
"What I mean, of course, is your real name," she said, narrowing her eyes.
"My dear young lady," I said, leaning forward, "as you may have read, some time ago I decided to become a politician. How dumb must any politician be who gives the folk a false name? How should people vote for him in such a case?" A vexed frown appeared on her face.
"Precisely. So why aren't you telling the German people what your real name is?"
"But I am," I sighed. This was very tiring. Particularly, as on the previous evening, until late, I had watched with interest a documentary which had drivelled on about my own miracle weapons. A highly amusing piece of twaddle, which broadly came to the conclusion that any of these weapons could have decided the war in our favour if I hadn't kept on ruining our chances. It is extraordinary what these history fantasists dream up without letting the facts get in their way. It hardly bears thinking about that even one's own knowledge of important men, such as Charlemagne, Otto the First, or Arminius, has, strictly speaking, been passed down by some historian who has felt himself called to the vocation.
"In that case, would you be so kind as to show us your passport?" the young woman asked. "Or your identity card?"
From the corner of my eye, I could see Sensenbrink wanting to say something. But chances are it would be poppycock. One never knows when and why such people start talking. Frequently they only open their mouths because they realize they haven't said anything yet, or because they're worried that if they continue to remain silent, they will be regarded as insignificant. This behavior must be halted with every means at one's disposal.
"Do you ask to see the passports of all your interviewees?"
"Only those who claim to be called Adolf Hitler."
"How many would that be?"
"I'm pleased to say you're the first."
"You are young and perhaps badly informed," I said. "But throughout my life I have always refused special treatment, and I have no intention of changing this now. I eat from the same field kitchen as any other soldier."
She said nothing for a short while, pondering a different approach.
"On television you speak about highly controversial topics."
"I speak the truth," I said, "and I say what the simple man is feeling, what he would say if he were in my place."
"Are you a Nazi?"
This was rather vexing.
What sort of question is that?
Of course! She leaned back. In all probability, she was not used to talking to someone who was not afraid of speaking his mind. It was remarkable how calm Savatsky remained, especially compared to Sensenbrink, who was now sweating almost embarrassingly.
Is it true that you admire Adolf Hitler?
Only in the mirror in the morning, I joked, but she impatiently ignored this.
Okay, let's be more precise. Do you admire the achievements of Adolf Hitler?
Do you admire the achievements of Ute Kassler?
We're not getting anywhere here, she said indignantly. Look, I'm not dead, am I?
You may be sorry to hear this, I said, but nor am I.
She pursed her lips. The waiter returned and handed round the refreshments.
Frau Kassler took a sip of coffee. Then she tried a new ruse.
Do you deny the deeds of the Nazis?
On the contrary, I am the first to refer to them. I never tire of it.
She rolled her eyes. But do you condemn them as well?
How idiotic would that be? I am not as schizophrenic as our parliamentarians, I grinned. This is the marvellous thing about the Führerstate. Not only is there someone responsible before and during it, but afterwards too.
For 6 million dead Jews as well?
For them especially. I wasn't keeping count, of course. A spark of triumph glinted in her eyes, until I said, But that's hardly anything new. If I've understood correctly, not even the press of the victors has disputed my accomplishment of having obliterated these parasites from the earth.
Her eyes flashed at me. And nowadays you're making jokes about it on the television, she hissed.
That's a new one on me, I said seriously. The Jews are no laughing matter.
She took a deep breath and leaned back once more.
After a gulp of her coffee, she tried again.
What do you do when you're not making your program? What do you get up to in your spare time?
I read a lot, I said. In many respects, this internet work is a pure delight, and I like to draw.
Let me guess, she said. Buildings, bridges, things like that?
Absolutely, I have a passion for architecture.
Yes, I've heard about that too, she groaned. Some of your stuff is still standing in Nuremberg.
Still? How nice, I said. I did my bit, but the glory really belongs to Albert Speer.
Let's stop there, she said icily. We're not getting anywhere. I don't get the impression that you came here today in a particularly cooperative frame of mind.
I do not recall that our negotiations in advance of this meeting included a secret protocol.
She signalled to the waiter for the bill, then turned to her photographer. Need any more pictures? He shook his head.
She stood up and said,
You'll read about this.
I stood up as well, and hotel reserver Savatsky, and Sensenbrink followed my lead.
Manners maketh man. The poor young creature could not help it that she had grown up in a world in disarray. I'm very much looking forward to it, I said. Look forward all you like, she said as she left.
Sensenbrink, Savatsky and I sat down.
So, that was a pretty short interview.
Savatsky said cheerfully, filling his cup.
No reason to let the coffee go to waste, guys. They make a damn fine cup here.
Oh, dear,
Sensenbrink fretted.
Those two left with a warm bowl of nothing.
They will write what they want anyway, I said. What I'd like them to do is to leave Fräulein Kurmeier alone.
How is she? Savatsky asked with concern.
Like the civil population of the Reich, the more the enemy drops his despicable bombs, the more fanatical the resistance becomes. A tremendous girl.
Savatsky nodded, and for a moment it appeared as if his eyes gleamed a touch too brightly.
but I may have been mistaken. Chapter 23. The problem with these parliamentarians is that they simply haven't understood a thing. I mean, why did I wage this war, for goodness sake? Not because I enjoy waging war. I hate waging war. If Bormann were still around, you could ask him. He'd back me up on the spot. It is a dreadful affair, and had there been a better candidate for the job, I would have gladly handed him the task. And now, well, I don't have to concern myself with it now, not in the short term, but in the medium and longer term, I expect the onus will fall on me once again. Who else would do it? Indeed, who else would do anything like it? Ask any parliamentarian these days, and he will tell you bluntly that wars are no longer necessary. That is the argument people were peddling back then, too, and it was as nonsensical as it is today. Our planet is not growing. That is incontestable. But the number of people living on it is. And if the world's natural resources become too scarce for the global population, which race will get hold of them? The nicest one? No, the strongest. And for this reason, I did my utmost to strengthen the German race and to kibosh the Russians before they overran us. At the last possible moment, or so I thought. Back then, there were, after all, 2.3 billion people alive on this earth. 2.3 billion! Nobody could possibly have imagined that this would increase threefold. But, and here is the key point, one needs to draw the right conclusion from this statistic. And the right conclusion is not that because there are now 7 billion of us, then all my efforts back then were unnecessary. The right conclusion is, if I was right in those days, then I am 3 times more right today. This is simple arithmetic as any elementary school pupil could tell you. Since my return, the issue has yet again become most evident. Why are there 7 billion people now living on Earth? Because I waged a war which was entirely, to use this newfangled word, sustainable. If all those people had since reproduced, we would now be at 8 billion. And it is beyond doubt that most of those would be Russians, who would have overrun our country, harvested our fruits, driven away our livestock, enslaved those of our men fit for labour, and slaughtered the rest, thus leaving themselves free to abuse our innocent young women with their filthy hands. Providence thus first charged me with the task of wiping out the excess Bolshevist population. And henceforth, my brief is to complete this mission. The intermezzo was necessary to preserve my strength over those decades, and now this strength is needed to see through the final outcomes of the war, namely, discord amongst the Allies, collapse of the Soviet Union, loss of Russian territory, and, of course, reconciliation with our closest ally, England, so that some day in the future we can act as one. It remains a mystery to me why that relationship never worked out. How many more bombs would we have had to drop on their cities before they realized that they were our friend? Looking at more recent figures, however, it is hard to understand why one might need England at all. That sick island is barely a world power anymore. Well, not all questions need to be answered at once. However, the last possible moment for taking drastic measures is gradually approaching. And for this reason, I was horrified at the state of the so-called nationalist forces of this country. To begin with, I had assumed that I was more or less on my own. But fate had already put one or two allies in place. The fact that, however, it took me months to discover that someone had felt called to continue the work of the NSDAP was proof of their inadequacy. I was so disgusted by their pathetic efforts at propaganda that I engaged the services of Assistant Director Bronner, together with a cameraman, and went to Berlin-Köpenick, home to the largest of these associations, which went by the name NPD.
And, I have to say, I was almost sick on the spot.
I grant that the Brown House in Munich had not exactly set the world on fire, but at least it was serious and representative. Or Paul Troost's administrative building, just a stone's throw away. That would have induced me to join any party in a jiffy. But this snow-covered dump in Berlin-Köpenick, it was a disgrace. There stood a miserable hovel, freezing in a gap between two tenement blocks, like a child's foot in his father's too large slippers. Even the building looked hopelessly overburdened, which may have been the result of some bird brain having come up with the great idea of giving this frightful shack a name and screwing it onto the facade in large, classically ugly letters. Karl Arthur Buering House. This was akin to a child's bathing ring being christened the Duke of Friedland. On the nameplate by the doorbell was written NPD Party Headquarters. So small that it smacked of cowardice in the face of the enemy. Unbelievable. It was just like the Weimar era. Yet again, the racial principle, the national question, was being dishonored, devalued, subjected to ridicule by a bunch of numbskulls. In a fury, I pressed the bell, and when there was no immediate reaction, I thumped it several times with my fist. The door opened.
"Can I help you?"
asked a pimply boy with a confused expression. "What do you think?" I said coldly.
"Have you got a permit to film?"
"What sort of dreadful whining is that?" I shouted at him. "Since when has a national movement ever hidden behind such oily southern tricks?" I forced the door wide open. "Get out of my way, boy! You are a disgrace to the German folk! Where is your superior?"
Hang on a sec. I'll go and fetch someone."
The youth disappeared, leaving us in some sort of reception room. I looked around. The place could have done with a paint, and it smelled of stale smoke. A few party programs were lying about, bearing absurd slogans. "Step on the gas," read one in inverted commas, as if one were in fact being urged to do the exact opposite. One sticker said, "Millions of foreigners are costing us billions." Of course, it failed to mention who would then manufacture the bullets and grenades for our troops, or who was supposed to excavate the bunkers for the soldiers at the front. Not the boy that I had seen, at any rate. He would have been just as useless with a shovel as he would in the field. Never have I felt so ashamed of a nationalist party. I had to brace myself at the prospect of the camera filming all this to prevent tears of rage from welling in my eyes. Ulrich Graf would not have taken 11 bullets to the body for these vermin. Von Scheibner-Richter would not have fallen under the fire of the Munich police so that these scoundrels in their squalid dump could exploit the blood of outstanding men. I heard the bewildered youth stammering into a telephone next door. The camera recorded everything, all the incompetence. It was a bitter experience, but there was nothing for it but to muck out this cesspit once and for all. In the end, I could bear it no longer. Seething with wrath, I marched into the next door room.
"Yeah, I would have chucked him out, but somehow he looks like Adolf Hitler. He's got the uniform."
I tore the receiver from the urchin's hand and screamed down the line.
"Which lame duck is in charge of these premises?"
It was astonishing how nimbly Assistant Director Bronner managed to slip around the table and, with unashamed delight, press a button on the telephone. Now, thanks to a loud speaker on the device, one could hear the answers perfectly well in the room.
"Please allow me,"
the loudspeaker said.
"If I allow anything here, you'll know about it,"
I bellowed.
"Why is there no supervisor in the office? Why is this four-eyed pipsqueak holding the fort? Get here at the double and account for yourself."
"Who on earth is that?"
the loudspeaker said.
Are you that madman off YouTube?
I admit that certain recent events may not be easy for the man on the street to comprehend. But we need to apply different standards in this instance. Anybody wishing to lead a nationalist movement must be able to react to the most unpredictable turns of fate. And when fate comes knocking at his door, he cannot ask, "Are you that madman off YouTube?" "Right," I said. "I'm assuming that you haven't read my book."
"No comment," the loudspeaker said. "And now you're going to leave the offices or I'll have you thrown out."
I laughed.
"I marched into France," I said. "I marched into Poland. I marched into Holland and into Belgium. I encircled hundreds of thousands of Russians before they could even make a peep. And now I find myself in your so-called offices. If you had a residue of sympathy